You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
This week on From Embers, we're featuring a special two-part series looking in-depth at the Lock Street Affair in Hamilton, Ontario. Back in March of 2018, the Steel City Anarchist Book Fair was held in Hamilton. The book fair featured literature tables, workshops, and social events, and was closely affiliated with The Tower, an anarchist social space in that city. The Saturday night of the book fair weekend, a group of about 30 people, many of them wearing masks, marched through the affluent neighborhood of Kirkendale, with some shooting off fireworks, attacking parked luxury cars, and dragging debris into the streets. The group then turned down Lock Street, an upscale commercial strip with many gentrifying small businesses. Some in the group smashed out storefront windows of closed businesses, threw smoke bombs into the street, and tossed eggs at windows of upscale restaurants as patrons watched from inside. After a brief rampage that the corporate media would come to call the Lock Street Riot, the group dispersed with no arrests. The damage to businesses was estimated at $100,000. In the days, weeks, and months that followed, there was a massive backlash against anarchists in Hamilton that saw a chorus of denunciation by multiple sectors of society, including politicians, journalists, police, far-right groups, and of course, business owners and their loyal citizens. After the tower was attacked by far-right goons the first time, they released a public statement denouncing gentrification in the city and asserting that while they had not organized the demonstration, they had, quote, zero tears to shed for Lock Street. The city of Hamilton attempted to classify the Circle A, which is a common anarchist symbol, as a banned hate symbol akin to the swastika, which would ultimately backfire for them as dozens of Circle A's were almost instantly painted across the city and ridicule in the media forced the city to backpedal. The tower would ultimately be evicted from their space, only to relocate to a larger, better space elsewhere in the city. In April, a collective house was raided and an individual affiliated with the tower and the book fair was arrested on numerous charges, including conspiracy and a new law from the Harper era, unlawful assembly while masked, which carries a maximum of 10 years in prison. In June, seven more individuals were arrested as police announced that they were opening investigations into years-old cases of mischief and vandalism in an attempt to further disrupt and criminalize the anarchist community in Hamilton. As court disclosures were shared with defendants, it became clear that an undercover police officer had been embedded in the Hamilton scene for some years, who would later be exposed on the anarchist counter-information website, North Shore Counter-Info. In late November, a plea deal was reached that saw a few months jail time for two of the defendants, house arrest for another, and a mix of probation and state charges for the rest. I spent an afternoon talking with a defendant who will be in jail when this episode is released. In part one, we discussed the context of gentrification in Hamilton and anti-capitalist struggles there, the demonstration on Lock Street, and the social backlash. In part two, we pick up from the first arrests and mostly focus on the question of state repression, navigating the court system, and the idea that resignation is worse than defeat.
Yeah, I'm an anarchist. I live in Hamilton. Lived there for a long time. I got charged in the Lock Street incident and have been on house arrest for a chunk of time. And at the time that you're hearing this, I'm probably already in jail as a result of a plea deal from those charges.
I guess my question for you to begin is just kind of, how would you like to set up this story? We're going to talk, I think, broadly about Lock Street, gentrification, repression. Where do you think the story begins?
That story, that moment, fits into kind of a longer trajectory of struggle around shifts in Hamilton that get referred to as gentrification, which I guess the way a lot of us feel it is just the process of kind of getting pushed out of the kind of neighborhoods and social fabrics that you live in as those neighborhoods and social fabrics become these more desirable commodities. So just kind of replacing one group of people with another in the same urban space. And then a bunch of other stuff that comes with it. A lot of the time, the most visible kind of aspects of that and the ones you can reach most easily are these boutique shops that are catering to a different clientele than's historically lived there and are attached to various forms of property speculation.
Maybe we should situate Hamilton in terms of historically, what kind of city is Hamilton and what's been happening? You lived in Hamilton for a long time.
Mm-hmm. This particular bubble that's happening right now that is this economic phenomenon dressed up as a cultural phenomenon. But one of the reasons that can happen and one of the reasons that there are such huge opportunities for people to get rich off of the suffering of others there is this kind of older story of economic collapse that I guess probably started in the city in the 70s, and that some of the words that get tossed around are just abandoned or hollowed out. It has to do with partially it's to do with deindustrialization in certain areas, which wasn't necessarily replaced with anything. And also just being close enough to Toronto that it's easily reached, but far enough away that it's sort of an independent space and operates its own kind of independent municipal government and things like that, and has its own social services, that as Toronto became more expensive during a time when Hamilton was still sort of in this space of kind of more collapse, that I guess starting in the early 90s, that social services in Toronto were actively kind of encouraging people to move to Hamilton, and also it was just a fact that you could live on sort of these welfare rates that are, or disability rates that are fixed across the province in Hamilton with a lot more ease and dignity than you could in Toronto and a lot of other surrounding cities. So, and then you also had this kind of concentration of social services building up in downtown Hamilton, which amalgamation increased as well, because then all the surrounding townships no longer were required to do their own social services, and a lot of that transferred to downtown as well. So you had these various forces that just led to a lot of folks who don't have a ton of economic options living quite geographically densely, which resulted in within the city and within the region and across the country, and just being having kind of this extremely negative reputation as being sketchy or dirty or crazy or whatever thing, you know. And it's which when you're in the middle of it, isn't it just I don't know if it's true or not, but just it's not the reality that people have. In practice, it ends up being a space where a regular city where people just have a particular kind of set of challenges that a lot of the time folks end up facing together a lot more than they have in other places that I've lived in. I mean, I feel like gentrification is I don't know, it's just a word that refers to a bunch of different stuff, you know, but just and so before I was paying attention or around, there were these processes of kind of dispossession and accumulation that just as especially commercial spaces and industrial spaces stopped being economically productive, there became opportunities for developers to consolidate them, right? And that kind of laid the groundwork for the stage that we're kind of in now, in which rising prices and investment makes it possible for people to take these properties that they've sometimes been sitting on for 30 or 40 years, making them just these kind of rat-infested problems for their neighbors, and expecting everyone to be super grateful when they start just driving prices up in the entire surrounding area in order to make as much money as they can off these buildings. But I guess the kind of more active part of gentrification that was centered on the downtown along James Street, it's hard to say when it started, but I think there's certain kinds of momentum and investment in the arts community that started in like the mid-2000s, early mid-2000s, that saw these kind of like deliberate efforts by this kind of existing like art scene and music scene and all these things to begin building more of an economy around themselves, you know, and so making it like a bit less of like a participatory thing and more of like a bit of a specialized thing in which there's like people who are seeking to make some or all of their living within that space. And in order to do that, you have to kind of attract the people who are willing to like consume in that mode, you know, who weren't the people who were living in the neighborhood already by and large. So they began creating this whole set of like kind of social and then later physical infrastructure to make specific neighborhoods appealing or like safe or hospitable for people who were prepared to just like dish out money to support these industries.
Yeah.
Whether that's through grants or through buying or through investing.
I remember the slogan, "Art is the new steel," was a big sort of symbol of that change.
Yeah, I think that came out in like 2009 or 2010.
Oh, a little later then.
It was a little bit later on, and I think by that point things were fairly established, right? And so like partly I feel like there's this thing that arts world tries to do sometimes is to saturate themselves within this like kind of productive like legacy of like the kind of appropriating certain like imagery and language from like organized working class struggles from that mostly don't exist anymore. And then partly it's making kind of a bold statement that at that time people were talking a lot about this sort of idea of like the creative economy and the creative class, and just sort of talking about the creative class as an ascendant class, which like is a little bit less like interesting or cool to say now. People don't talk about it in the same way, but at the time it was this idea that essentially like CEOs and investors and entrepreneurs belong to the same class as like artists and musicians and like academics and like things like that, people who just like deal in the realm of ideas. And so it was kind of this bigger sense, which I think was ultimately just like a lie. I think a lot of the people who were on the like artist musician side of that actually were like being duped. Mm-hmm. But it's this belief that those people have like a shared set of economic interests and can operate in like a similar space to the benefit of all, right? So like that one thing we saw a lot that would be kind of touted as one of those examples would be real estate investors partnering with arts groups to like fix up buildings in exchange for allowing them to like use them temporarily. Or like cities, like the city like handing out grants or making educational funding available to places that do like some amount of like arts education as part of their like larger project, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that came out kind of in 2010 that there was a text that got talked about a lot called To the Foot Soldiers of Gentrification, that was essentially making the argument that just like artists and the kind of surrounding milieu were just being used as sort of these shock troops to open up an urban space for others, essentially, right? And so because at that time you had these artists who were doing the grunt work of like creating these spaces and like these, and sometimes like small business owners, but even then not so much, to create these spaces, who were began doing things like forming associations that could like lobby for more cameras and that could like, you know, just push corners that they considered, where people who they consider undesirable would hang out like further and further away from what they were trying to do. So that just kind of laid the groundwork for this transition from like galleries and show venues or things like that towards like businesses.
Like, I think one of the challenges that people who are trying to resist gentrification have, especially when it's in the earlier stages, when there's this like foot soldier effect and there's a lot of artists and creative types that are like driving it, that we have such close social proximity to so many of those people that it can often be a really difficult conflict to have, because it's not like some suit in a tower that you never interact with.
That's
like
right.
People that you might call friends.
That's right. And I think that was something that was surprising to a lot of us at first, is that we thought we were going out picking fights with police and investors, but the people who came to meet us to fight back were people from the arts scene, from like the music scene, who were like longtime people who might have been like activists or who were just very generally invested in building this community, who'd like now owned like a partial stake in like X business or like had a buddy who does Y thing or like exactly what you said, that social proximity, I would say it just caused a lot of people to act against their own interests. That like it was during the same period of time that just like rents along James Street tripled and a bunch of people like lost their homes or things like that, and like the process of kind of people getting priced out of their like studio and gallery spaces and losing access to the concert venues and things like that was already beginning. But yeah, so I think in some ways, like one of the ways we came to understand the anti-gentrification struggle that we chose to engage in, like there's obviously other possibilities was to attempt to drive a wedge in between the developers, the real estate agents, and the city planners, and people who were in it for this like community-minded idea, and especially those who had some form of like progressive politics, right? That, and I think that was just this like complicated dynamic, is because like all of these business owners, like they don't want to just like make a bunch of money in a context of like rising prices and increasing misery. They also want to be like universally loved and admired and be considered these like saviors, you know, like whether it's using a language of like job creators or like community-minded business or like social entrepreneurship or whatever garbage is like the flavor of the year, you know. And they needed this like this kind of sphere of sometimes activists, sometimes cultural people, sometimes like whatever around them to make that work, right? They need this like echo chamber of congratulations. Because otherwise, like, you know, they're just a regular business. They're not like this, because I feel like they would think about themselves as this like movement that was reinventing cities and breathing life into spaces in which there was none, which is obviously garbage. Like, it involved every step of the way pushing people physically out of the places that they were in order to take their space. So it was extremely bitter. Like, I don't know. I think it's one of those things where it's like hard to look at a gentrification struggle like the one in Hamilton and feel great about it, because mostly it just involved like drawing really clear lines with people who like maybe were your friends. Mm-hmm. And just like making clear like what is going on and like whose side you're on, right? Like, are you on the side of your neighbors, or are you on the side of the like cool guy who sometimes hosts shows who is like calling the cops on them every day, you know? And like, I don't know, just choices like that, and so we would just try to dramatize those conflicts, make them play out in the streets, make people like argue with each other, fight over ideas, so that at the very least, if people were going to climb into bed with developers, they'd have to admit that they were doing it. Mm-hmm.
I remember reading a text that I think was published through the Hamilton Institute called Now That It's Undeniable, which I thought was really a really good text for explaining some of these processes, and specifically the role of what are called, I think, progressive urbanists,
right,
in driving development. And I believe one of the proposals that gets advanced in terms of how to struggle against gentrification is like this idea of just pure negation, like refusing to propose an alternative way of developing the city, because it's always going to turn into crap. Like, because who actually controls development at the end of the day?
It's one of those things where it's a struggle. It's hard to feel good about, because it's hard to feel super enthusiastic about a struggle that is based on just saying no to stuff. But I think it's actually important to do that. Like, I think a lot of the time these sort of kind of like liberal democratic frameworks are based around people having like a clear position, a clear proposal that is like in some way for everyone, you know. But I feel like as an anarchist, I'm just not trying to do anything for everyone. I'm trying to actually like end the world in which anyone does anything for everyone. Like, I want to make space for like many different things to be possible without like imposition or coercion. That text, like, it was distributed, it was published online on this like weird blog that is very dear, but was kind of promoted by being some excerpts of it were put up on posters and just like glued up all over the downtown. And one of the kind of few advantages of the kind of dynamic of like those kind of close relationships and the bitterness that I was talking about before is that it doesn't actually take much to like provoke huge dramatic reactions from people, because of that dynamic in which like everybody just thinks they're like so virtuous for pursuing their self-interest, you know? And so when you put out something like that that criticizes things in kind of strong language, like, people just leap on it and have to like reassure each other so much, you know? And it doesn't necessarily lead to honest engagement with the ideas, but it does mean that like things circulate, critique is visible, people who are grossed out by what's going on can find those critiques if they want them, you know? So the particular idea of negation, I feel like it's just based on the idea that having a city that is like centrally planned like is desirable, and just like refusing that, you know, because I think a lot of the time people point to these things like, oh, we're like densifying, we're like building transit, we're beautifying cities, we're like making them more livable, we're creating local communities, we're, you know, we're doing all this great stuff, we're creating jobs, you know, and like, who doesn't like that? And it's just, I do just argue that text argues, and I would argue that you can't separate those kinds of things from the context in which they occur, right? Like, you can't just take a light rail line or a tower and separate it from its social context and what it produces and what produces it, you know? So to just take the idea that you've like built a tower in an area that used to be like a three-story set of apartments above shops and say that that is like better because it's denser, just ignores the kinds of like processes of displacement, who is investing and why, what is like the trajectory of the neighborhood that's going in, who benefits from these arrangements in terms of how power is constructed within the neighborhood. And I guess any given technology you could think of that way, that it embodies like a web of relationships as well, right? So I think just like if we're focusing on the webs of relationships, I think it's more interesting to start from that direction and be like, how do we want to relate to each other? And just like the kind of main thing we can throw back in the face in the gentrification argument is just being like, what we want is just like solidarity with our neighbors. We want to encourage forms of relationships that are based on like actually getting to know each other and like addressing basic needs and like starting from this place of like human dignity and like simplicity, rather than like grand schemes about what hypothetically is the best for everyone taken together. Because like to me, there just is no everyone. Like there is no people of Hamilton. Like,
and like Lock Street was not the first attack on gentrifiers that happened in Hamilton. Like I've seen stuff over the years where other gentrifying businesses were vandalized or tours of developers were disrupted.
Yeah, for sure. I think like Lock Street was a big kind of departure from how things have been happening before. But I think there had been this trajectory of trying to do things that are like a little bit more offensive, you know, and not simply engaging critique. And part of that is just like finding some small ways to like fight back against this process seems just like a minimum for dealing with all the like evictions and like joblessness and like precarity and policing and garbage that we're all fucking living through. It just seems like a minimum to do that with dignity, that just to at least be able to say like, I fought back. Like I didn't let them just do it smiling, you know? And in some ways it's just, it kind of feels bad if all we can do is like just make the process of gentrification uncomfortable for everyone. But you know what, if that's all we can do, then maybe we should still just do it. And that like, if we're just gonna end up losing our homes and having to move away anyway, then there is like a form of satisfaction just knowing that people didn't get to trumpet it as like some sort of great humanitarian victory for progressivism. So yeah, I guess like over the years there's been like a lot of kind of offensive postering, I guess, of like just posters getting stuck up all over like businesses or and around them. Same with like stickers. There's been like a bunch of windows that get broken. There's been a bunch of other just kind of like vandalism that's happened. When you mentioned that tour of developers, there was a tour called Try Hamilton that was organized by a group of real estate agents to bring investors from other cities to come and just like see what's possible in East Hamilton. And the tour got ambushed by a group of, I guess, demonstrators who pelted them with gross shit until they fled onto their bus. But I think just generally things like that, like again, it's like you can't stop the tour, but you can make the rest of the thing happen in a space in which people feel that what they're doing is not welcome, right? That like they can, we can't stop them from hanging around on a rooftop patio of like a hyper rich bar in an extremely policed quarter next to the police station. But we can stop them from feeling like they're ever going to be part of a meaningful community in Hamilton, you know, like they're always going to be up there on the roof of the patio under armed guard. And that isn't the same as winning, but it's, I don't know, feels better than just letting them do it.
And did these actions, were they publicly known about very much? And were folks able to get much of a sense of how they were received, like, prior to the Lock Street stuff?
To my knowledge, none of this stuff ever gets promoted publicly, as far as I know. It's possible I just don't find out about it. But, yeah, I feel like stuff, I mean, here and there, right? Sometimes things get talked about a lot. Oftentimes it'd be, not always, but it seems like oftentimes there'd be like texts that would come out where people would kind of like say, yeah, here's what I did, here's why. And again, one of those things where just like all of Hamilton is really, it has this weird inferiority complex about just being the kind of like scuzzy city that is like the butt of all the jokes and is just like, you know, just once a decade produces this narrative in which it's just like, this is it, this is the time that like Hamilton's gonna be the next big thing, and this time it seems like it actually isn't. So everybody's like really full on just like navel gazing about how great this process they feel like they're involved in is. So when a thing happens that like doesn't fit with that narrative or just that like gives the other side to the story, then like a lot of media just like pounces on it, you know. So there were moments of just like some communique about a window getting broken being reprinted almost in full in like the local newspaper, or just weird things like that that in most places and in most contexts would be kind of unheard of. But for whatever reason, it just like sometimes would get around. And I mean, one of the things that come with that is that like the people who make the most noise are generally speaking, like, extremely hostile to that kind of action, and are typically, like the boosterism is, like, very intense, right? So
the chattering classes.
Yeah, there you go. So I think just, like, getting used to just kind of being hated is also just, like, an interesting political exercise where it's like, oh, yeah, you can't necessarily, like, engage with these issues with integrity and be a bit uncompromising about what you actually just think is right, and expect to be loved by, like, random people on the internet, you know? Or just, like random people who you used to chat with at the bar or, like, anything like that, you know? And just... So I think that's just been interesting, too, because I think one of kind of the baggages that we inherit from, like, leftism is just this idea that everything needs to be mass, it needs to be growing, it needs to be popular, it needs to, like, kind of bring everybody in. And I just don't think it does. I think, like, one of the things this has made really clear to me is that we need to embrace conflict. We need to, like, embrace the fact that people either have fundamentally different economic interests or have just, like, made a choice to ally themselves with, like, certain sides, you know, and, like, that there are sides, and that... Sure, there's, like, space for negotiation and change and discussion, but sometimes there's just conflict and fights. And, like, that's just a more honest way of engaging with it than trying to seek to, like, manage things indefinitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is the next part of this the Lock Street affair?
I guess so, yeah.
So, it was the weekend of the Anarchist Book Fair.
That's right. If y'all don't know, there's, like, a tradition of anarchists doing book fairs. I don't know where it comes from. But probably from a time before the internet when it was really essentially impossible to get any sort of, like, anarchist text through, like, mainstream, like, bookstores or, like, things like that. And so people kind of had to develop their own distribution networks, which essentially looked like these kind of convergences that people would organize, in which publishers and stuff from all over would come. And then people from those towns would hold workshops and discussions and often use that as, like, an organizing space as well as, like, a space to, like, exchange ideas through, like, a larger network than they usually have access to. So this happened in Hamilton consistently for, like, a number of years. It tapered off, I think, in, like, 2013, and then other cities have been holding them, but I think there's pretty consistently been at least one book fair every year in Southern Ontario since, like, 2006 or something, or 2007. So some people in Hamilton had decided to do that. I was one of the organizers of the book fair, and... It's also, like, very common at book fairs, though by no means, like, universal, that people just kind of call demos during them, right? So just, like, oftentimes, like, some leaflets will circulate or someone will make an announcement and be like, hear me here at this time for, like, a demo about X thing that's going on, you know? At this book fair, there were, like, a bunch of flyers that were, like, hanging around that were calling for a demo that evening, the evening of the Saturday. And then, like I said before, it was using some, like, pretty inflammatory, like, fuck the rich language. I didn't think too much of it, handed it a few of these leaflets, and I guess, like, conversations about that demo beforehand had been pretty sparse, that, like, we organize a lot of demos, you know, and I think that it's easy to get into this mode in which you accept things moving very gradually and accept this form of, like, inertia in which, like, you know, like, we know how to organize, like, a demonstration. We know how to organize an unpermitted demonstration. Like, we do it a lot. They all kind of look the same. Like, maybe there's, like, tiny bits of, like, escalation or things like that that might happen differently. But, like, generally speaking, it's not a thing we need to think about a ton before we do. I think when we're thinking about this demo, we're imagining just what we talk about as, like, a noise demo, right? Which is often a demo that's called at the last minute or isn't promoted publicly, in which, like, people just show up often at prisons to just, like, make a ton of noise and, like, set off fireworks and, like, stuff like that. So preparations for this demo included, like, fireworks and sound systems and, like, that kind of thing. And the intention was to kind of march through this rich neighborhood and kind of, like, pass by the houses of, like, specific city planners and bureaucrats and, like, real estate agents and stuff like that, who all kind of live in this one, like, kind of rich enclave at the foot of the escarpment and at one end of Lock Street, which is, you know, not, like, a particularly significant commercial street in the city. Like, there's some talk about it being, like, a first gentrified area, and, like, sure, you can make an argument that it is or isn't. It is just, like, has a suite of shops on it that are, like, frequented by, like, a much more affluent group of people, but not exclusively. So the intention of it, as far as I knew, was way less about Lock Street and way more about the people.
The residential neighborhood.
That's right. And, like, who specifically lives there, and kind of to make this argument of being like, well, you can come to our homes and fuck with us, and we just want you to remember that, like, it's a short walk. So this demo got promoted. And I guess one of the self-criticisms that I would have, and I know some other people have, is, like I said, that kind of, like, complacency around, like, inertia and expecting things to kind of always look the same. And I think the thing that we can forget is that when we organize a demo, when we organize a book fair, we're creating a container in which many things become possible, and it becomes possible for people to engage in many different ways. And ideally, like, as anarchists, we want some sort of like fundamental rupture with the present. Like, we don't want to continue with this like incrementalism and like day to day. And so when we create these containers, ultimately we're hoping that they get filled with something unexpected. We never really expect them to, because at a certain point you've done 100 demos, they all kind of look the same. There's no reason why demo 101 is going to be the one that is like fundamentally different. But I would say that you always have to think that it's going to, right? And you always have to prepare yourself and like think about what happens if like this is the night that my like weird revenge dream happens to like play out in front of my eyes or something. And yeah, so I know I personally was definitely not expecting the things that happened to happen, and like didn't show up ready for it. Like, I think, like, you know, I was like hanging around an event that I organized, handing out leaflets while on camera to strangers.
There were cameras in the book fair.
There were cameras in the book fair. We rented a venue from the school board, and schools have cameras because safety. You're more safe when you're on camera. Yeah, so just like leafleting random strangers, one of whom turned out to be an undercover police officer, who'd been hanging around for about 2 years, I guess. But yeah, like showed up at the demo, things like rapidly turned in a different direction. And I want to be clear, like I feel like I wouldn't always want to say about like, oh, I didn't know, things like that, because I want to be clear that like I have absolutely no problem with what happened. It was like a beautiful thing. I want to like stand by the folks who did it. I think it's like totally appropriate to have these like moments where you remind people who spend their lives profiting off fucking with you that things can like come back at them, you know, and just like remembering that this is like a physical conflict that they're engaged in. They get to use proxies of like the police sometimes, or like underlings or employees, and we don't, but these moments can happen. So yeah, just like full solidarity with those folks, whoever it was who decided to do that. And yeah, so this like demo happened, turned in a different direction, was like beautiful and scary and all of these things. And yeah, it was extremely polarizing and has then occupied the next 8 months of my life.
What are your thoughts on people that dress up in black, wear masks, go out at night, and smash windows?
They're cowards. Screw them, honestly. Like, why? What's the point?
Horrible. That's the lowest of the low.
If you're going to smash a window, do it in broad daylight and show your face.
Totally astounded, baffled, crazy.
What are your thoughts, buddy?
Fun.
He's talking about when they broke all the windows and wore masks.
Not fun.
Maybe could you, when you say every demo kind of looked the same in Hamilton until this one, what was the kind of level of escalation at a typical Hamilton anarchist demo prior to that, and what kind of stuff happened that was new?
Yeah, and it's cool the new things happen, and I'm just going to keep saying it over and over that I feel like I kicked myself for finding myself in a space in which I was like super unprepared, and I don't. Yeah, it's just, it's like there's no way of regretting seeing an Audi get its window smashed out, you know? Like, it's just not in my heart to ever regret that happening. But a typical Hamilton demo, I feel like there'd been sort of like a process in works that some of us had been involved in over many years of trying to have like actual demonstrations in Hamilton, which mostly, for those of you who aren't in Ontario, you don't maybe haven't been to the most socially pacified place in the world with the least history of social movements. Maybe there's places that are worse. But like in Ontario, like there just aren't demonstrations. They don't happen. Like the maximum you might get a lot of the time is like some sort of group of people with a permit standing on the sidewalk. But so I feel like there was kind of a process that we tried to participate in that looked to first like move things off sidewalks and into streets, then move things into being in the streets and going where you want, and then moving things into like overcoming the various kinds of police resistance in the streets in order to do whatever we want, and then move towards like forms of tactical freedom, like stickering or paint actions or like things like that that would happen. Even those were kind of rare. I feel like that had been kind of at an impasse for a couple years, because I think at first the police didn't know how to do crowd control and would just sort of get really physically aggressive and start like attacking people and things like that. And then we'd have this chance to kind of like hang together and like defend each other and like get to have this like funny little win. but like really the win was just that like you got to march down the street and do nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, you just got to exist as a group of people in public. And I think at a certain point they like figured out that like charging into crowds with horses and like things like that was like kind of counterproductive. And then they started doing what every city that sometimes has protests does, and just like have people who are there for crowd control who like keep their distance, you know, and like don't give you easy conflicts. So I think at that point things didn't really like escalate very far beyond that. We also had this kind of practice of doing, like I said, like noise demos or things like that that aren't promoted like super publicly. And like, so the prison demos have been happening annually for about 10 years, for instance, where people just go around to different prisons in the region and make a ton of noise. Sometimes tag the jail. Like there's a really cute Black December tag on the outside of the Barton Jail in Hamilton that's been there for a few years that was in solidarity with Greek prisoners a couple years ago. So things like that, and that's just like, I mean, the reason those aren't promoted is because it's not about getting out numbers, it's not about doing media, it's about having just kind of like a direct moment of connection to like break the isolation of prisoners and to just like for the people who are there to just have like these kind of clear moments of being like, no, we're against all these forms of social control, like prisons, like walls, like human beings behind bars. Yeah, so I think that's kind of where things had been for like a number of years, was at this level in which like people could kind of have demonstrations, there was like a little bit of space to maybe do some sort of intervention within them, but not very much. I don't think there'd ever been a window broken during a protest before in the history of Hamilton, which is like, not to say that that's not a thing that ever crossed anyone's mind, it's just like, because incrementalism or because of just like various things just like never felt possible or never felt relevant or never felt strategically wise, like I don't know, probably there's a lot of conversations that could happen about it. But yeah, so I think it's just one of those things that it meant that a lot of us, I think, were kind of caught flat-footed when there's like a context in which suddenly there's not just like the one broken window in a demo, but just like dozens and dozens. And which in some ways is just like cool and beautiful. It's like a little bit outside of the trajectory of the forms of escalation that we've been on. But at the same time, I think is like, yeah, just like making space for those unexpected things to happen and being ready to like make a defense of them and to like understand them and be like, no, actually, like this is not fundamentally different than what we do the rest of the time, because what we do the rest of the time is about creating spaces that like can't be controlled and in which we get to feel collectively powerful, you know. And if in one of those spaces this is what we had decided to do, then like that would be great too. I would stand by that as well, you know. And I think it's again just like looking at like what are the sorts of like social relationships and structures of power that come from it, right? And I think if we're trying to just build forms of kind of autonomy in the streets and like make the streets a space where people actually can be strong and can like express themselves and like can kind of just like constitute a force and like push back against things, then like, yeah, you're gonna have moments like that.
One thing that I thought about too when you were discussing pacified Ontario is like the one exception in my anarchist lifetime that I can think of would be the G20 in Toronto, where right. things again like I think escalated beyond what most people imagined would happen at that. And there were a lot of comparisons drawn between the G20 and the Lock Street stuff and by the media, which yep. tends to over-exaggerate things. But what kind of... Do you think there's a connection between these two experiences?
I mean, so I was also charged with conspiracy for the G20 riots.
That's kind of a leading question.
Which, like, for the state is super convenient, right? Because then they can draw this link in between the two things. But to me, I'm like, these things had nothing in common. Mm-hmm. Like, summit protests are, like, extremely ritualized. They involve, like, huge crowds of people coming from other places. They involve, like, what exists of this left in Canada actually kind of trying to mobilize itself. Like, it's just, like, the one time every 5 years that, like, a bunch of, like, labor unions, like, drag themselves out to, like, do something. It's just, I don't know. So... it would almost be more surprising if you had a G20 summit that didn't have giant protests and riots and stuff like that in them. Like, it's not surprising to anyone, and that narrative that this is going to happen existed long before anybody started trying to like plan for confrontational marches during the summit. Mm-hmm. And all that was done like fairly openly as well, right? Like, there were all of the calls for those demos like went out months in advance, were mailed across the continent and around the world. Like, yeah, people were going to like union offices and NGO offices and being like, here's what we're planning, like, how do we do this in a way that's like respectful of difference, but no, we're still going to try to have a combative demonstration. Yeah, like
businesses boarded up their windows,
yeah,
media hyped it up,
the police like threatened everyone so intensely that the city just turned into a ghost town, and there were just like squads of 20 cops on bikes roaming around arresting anyone with a backpack. Like, it was a different moment, you know. It just, I think the thing with Lock Street was that it felt like an intrusion into daily life a lot more. Even though the G20, like, the amount of property damage was like hugely more, like at least 10 times more. Like, there were single individuals in the G20 who got charged with 10 times the amount of property damage of the total Lock Street thing. But yeah, I think the amount of just like shock and fear and anger was like much greater for the Lock Street thing, actually.
Good evening. Shock and anger in Hamilton's Lock Street neighborhood tonight. Police say a mob of 30 people went on a vandalism spree as witnesses watched on in horror. Let's go live now to CTV's Maliha Sheikh.
Store windows smashed. Vehicles vandalized. This is the aftermath of a brazen attack in Hamilton's Lock Street neighborhood.
They were setting off smoke bombs, fireworks, as well as they had rocks that they were throwing at vehicles and some homes in the neighborhood.
They, according to police, a mob dressed in black, some members even wearing masks, carrying a sign that read, "We are the ungovernables."
We had to amass a large contingent of police officers to deal with the group.
There must have been, I don't know, 30 cop cars. There was a horse trailer. There was heavily armed police in cars, which looked like they had some kind of assault rifles, as well as dogs.
Sorrow.
I'm beyond sad.
And shock.
It's been in the past 5 years that you've seen this beautiful gentrification and a whole bunch of small businesses popping up and the entrepreneurial spirit and the artists coming back to Hamilton.
Normally a thriving part of the city, now many forced to close their doors to deal with damages.
We do know that there was an anarchist book fair going on in Hamilton at Westdale High School over the weekend, so we are investigating to see if there's any potential links to any people attending that.
A community eagerly awaiting answers after an unjust attack.
You're listening to From Embers. This episode is examining the context, lead up to, and aftermath of the Lock Street affair in Hamilton. We'll be right back after a short musical break.
M-A-R-S-E-I-2-L-E est à la rue. Je reconnais plus ma ville, je ne reconnais plus ma rue. Où est mon centre-ville, celui d'avant a disparu. Q-N-Q-S-C-V à tous ces enfants de la rue. À nos rues incomptées, génération du crabu. Ma ville entière a sombré, soumise, ombrée. Pour en faire une belle ville de la côte d'Azur. Marseille City en chantier, dernier coup de massue. En faveur de leur modèle, des dossiers sous leur cocktail. Grotesque à l'heure où mes frères saluent. Pendant qu'ils construisent leurs hôtels, plus belle est ma ville que dans vos têtes. Marseille refaite à notre insu. Petit déliment, je longue peine. Au gommette ou à l'une, pour pas grand chose dorénavant, on te fera dur. Qu'est-ce qu'est devenue la Joliette après expulsion par centaines, certainement parce qu'on aurait voulu. Où est passée la ville du bled? Paraît que ce temps est révolu, capitale de la culture européenne. Si c'était une blague, c'est sûr qu'on ne l'aurait pas cru. Marseille redessinée par Euromède, venu chambouler toute la culture de la ville. L'écart se creuse, ressent la fracture qui souffre. Marseille, capitale de la rupture. Capitale de la rupture. Capitale de la rupture. Trop peu sont opposés aux colons de la belle cité de Fossé. Tous leurs plans ne sont qu'à l'opposé de la tradition, de l'esprit de la ville millénaire qui a toujours assemblé les communautés. Terre d'accueil ouvert à l'autre, rebelle au roi, terre d'asile des apôtres. Commence à la porte de l'Orient, élu capitale de la culture. M-A-R-S-E-I-2-L-E est à la une. Je reconnais plus ma ville, paraît qu'elle est devenue bien une. Chaque des cultures, 2013, prix de vitesse, flic et caméra à chaque coin de rue. Expulsé pour du business, compte ce qui reste. Esprit démoli comme ces murs qu'on a toujours tenus. Alors je dédicace les petites teignes anti-système. Qu'on souhaite en cage ou pire, qu'est-ce que les miens vont devenir. Nos rues se remplissent de tristesse. Un genre d'apartheid se dessine. La zone n'était pas que livrée. La camaraderie, la vraie, la joie, y'avait pas de carabine. Car la génie cesse, ici la jeunesse est en péril. Rien n'est fait pour elle et ça c'est vrai depuis des piges. Entassé dans des blocs, la celle ici c'est dans le chip. Plus de place dans les réseaux donc ça tire dans le vif. Refont nos quartiers et nous virent. Pendant que la misère s'accroît, tranquille se pavanent les touristes. Pendant que mes frères sont au placard, partout les caméras nous fixent. Pour mieux aseptiser chaque place et l'identité de la ville. Marseille, capitale de la rupture. Capitale de la rupture. Capitale de la rupture. Capitale de la rupture. Marseille, capitale de la rupture. Capitale de la rupture. Capitale de la rupture.
Hamilton police were not seemingly expecting that demonstration, or like nobody was arrested at the demonstration. It all happened in the weeks and months afterwards.
Right.
Despite the fact there was an undercover cop at the demonstration.
Yeah, good question, eh?
What's up with that? Do we know what's up with that?
No, it's one of those things that will probably remain unclear. There is an article that appeared about this undercover cop that was published on North Shore Counterinfo and other places that I spent a lot of time with this undercover cop. He didn't actually succeed in infiltrating anybody. He just kind of hung around and came out to socials at the tower and came out to things that were promoted publicly. But yeah, as far as I know, everything in that article is accurate.
He's a Hamilton police officer?
He's a Hamilton police officer. But one of the questions that exists is that one thing that they did, that the state did for the G20, was to organize various policing and intelligence agencies into a joint, what they call JIGs, joint intelligence groups. So the idea with that is to just unify the command across like geographic areas and various jurisdictions, to just like allow for a coordinated response to what they consider like exceptional security events, like summits. Right, and so as if by coincidence, there was a G7 summit this summer happening in Quebec City, and we know that there was a JIG that was formed for that as well. And I don't know, like one of the weird things about doing a project like the Tower or like the Book Fair is that they're just like huge lightning rods. Like we're just standing up and saying like, yeah, we have like some unpopular politics, you know, and we're gonna like talk about them like eloquently and openly, and we're gonna like be friendly about them, you know, and that just if there was gonna be like one kind of activity that was going to get infiltrated in Ontario in connection to a JIG centered in Quebec, it would probably be something like that, you know? So the theory that I have, who knows if it's true, is that Shane initially appeared, was around for about a year and a half in connection to possibly a JIG, but was dealing mostly with pipelines. There was like a campaign against the Line 9 pipeline that was happening in Southern Ontario with a lot of stuff in Hamilton. So, and then I think he was probably withdrawn, and he has this story about having gone out west. But he then reappeared a few years later and mostly tried to hang around the tower and go to anti-gentrification things and talk to people about development and make dumb, weird comments about how he is so glad to find people who hate the police too, or like things like that. So my theory is that he just got like retaken up by this like by the next big intelligence operation, and that would possibly explain why local police didn't have access to that information, because it was in this extra this like other hierarchy that was reporting to this like JIG kind of central committee rather than to like Hamilton police and its detectives. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think it probably took them a while to like decide to burn their undercover. But yeah, and it's also, I feel like that also explains why out of the 8 people who ended up getting charged for Lock Street, only one person's alleged to have broken anything. And they essentially just like rounded up everybody who, well, not everybody, but a bunch of people who openly and consistently do things at the tower and who spend the most time talking to strangers.
So the demo happens, there's fireworks, broken windows, I think I read there were some rocks thrown at a cop car, and nobody's arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the middle, this is the night between the 2 days of the Hamilton Anarchist Book
That's
Fair.
Right.
What was it like as an organizer of the book fair to be there the day after?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely like a little bit stressful. I feel like organizing the book fair is already like a lot of work. And it's part of the reason why maybe like more intention didn't go in on some of our parts into like thinking about the demo, is just because like, I know personally, I was just like, I don't want to like think or even like hear about this. Like, I'm going to go to this thing and I'm going to like do the stuff that we do for demos, but I'm just gonna be like organizing like workshops and tabling all day, you know? But yeah, I think like the next day, just had already like been circulated pretty widely with people just like being like, oh, this is the book fair it's doing, you know? So we got like, just had to fend off a bunch of like media crews, and there's like obvious undercover cops hanging around, and like, but things only escalated from there actually. That the Sunday of the book fair was almost like, yeah, it was almost a vacation compared to what happened afterwards. But yeah, I think just one of the things that was just interesting was that these kinds of like backlash that happened around anti-gentrification stuff that had already been happening, it was like, you know, when we talked about with texts and critiques coming out and people having these like really emotional, hyper-defensive reactions, that was just like to the next level, like fully unchained in this one. And you had every level of government coming out to like pose for selfies and do news conferences in front of like the boarded up windows of some shop selling $7 donuts. And like you had groups of like fascists and like like the Soldiers of Odin and the Proud Boys, like holding rallies in support of like these small business owners who are good patriots. And so just like weird surreal images of like 1 week earlier Justin Trudeau standing inside one business like eating some stupid pastry, and then the next week like a bunch of like jacketed up like far right goons standing in the exact same spot doing the same photo op. And it's just like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. The level of agreement across all of these parts of like Canadian society, ranging from like just like anti-immigrant street patrol groups to like the prime minister, that just like everybody is just in agreement that like small businesses are like the most awesome, and there's like no possible reason why anybody would like cause economic damage to them. Which I think is just like, it's like interesting and it's stark, you know? And like one thing that was interesting too is I think it just like encouraged a lot of people who hate anarchists and who hate opponents of gentrification to just kind of like up their game a little bit. And so the space got like physically attacked a few times, the tower. So yeah, like the windows got broken, and then one night some people like kicked the door down and like wrecked the library, or like tried to wreck the library. They damaged like 6 books or something. And then like one day we had like a bunch of these like far right losers like get drunk and show up and get punched in the face in front of the space. I feel like the backlash is like just the most interesting part about all this. It's hard to even know how to approach it. And I think a bunch of different things were happening during that period of time. And like one of them was the production of this kind of like counter narrative that would initiated with the police that attempted to, I don't know if it was depoliticize the action, because I think that was hard to do. Like even before any texts came out describing the action or claiming it, the link to gentrification and to previous anarchist activity was like obvious. It was made by everyone. It took maybe 15 minutes for people to be like, oh, this is like the same kind of shit. They couldn't depoliticize the action and be like, this is just senseless, mindless hate or some crap. Their attempt was to frame it as a coordinated and deliberate like political attack on specific targets, rather than as a demonstration, which, like I said, is you're making a space in which many things are possible. And like a demonstration is like heterogeneous, contains many different possible intentions, many different ways of engaging, lots of different people who don't necessarily know each other. Whereas like a coordinated attack implies something that's like more militaristic, more intentional, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's like a little bit, like if that's what we were doing, we were like really bad at it or something. Because it's like, I'm not going to go around promoting my coordinated attack on camera in the book fair, you know? And it's just like, I feel a little bit defensive about that, because I'm like, y'all think I'm an idiot, but it's just, I don't know, maybe I am, who knows. So this narrative was being produced that was attempting to situate this thing not as a demonstration, and I think that since that was kind of like the dominant narrative that people were hearing, I think that also got like internalized a lot, and a lot of like intention kind of got imputed to those actions by people who are close to it. And so it also meant that just like the way social media functions, just like a lot of people who have like kind of proximity to like anarchists or who do anti-gentrification things or like express those politics on the internet in any way, were suddenly kind of getting this like thrown in their face of being like, oh, do you support this? Do you support this? Will you like dissociate yourself from this? You know? And I think that was like legitimately like really hard for a lot of people, right? And in the same way that it's already like a struggle, it's really bitter and hard on relationships. Like I think that it drew the line certainly very clearly, possibly not in the most like skillful or eloquent way. I think that just resulted in this space where those of us who couldn't or wouldn't step away from our politics and like from these struggles, and who were, you know, who were like dealing with smashed spaces and like chasing journalists out of the book fair and like things like that, we're then having to like look to the people who we always like rely on and like moments of struggle, and seeing like a lot of doubt there. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just like one of the most challenging parts. And like, I think it took and it takes work to just kind of like rebuild those relationships and like rebuild trust. And yeah. And then I think especially as like the kind of conflict and like the situation like dragged on, though, I think it became like a little bit easier for people to do. Like I think in the kind of like extremely panicky first days that were mostly playing out in the realm of opinion, I think it was maybe harder for people to like see things clearly and like pick sides. But I think like once the space started getting damaged and it became like, oh, I can like show up and help rebuild a door, or just like help defend the space while it can't be locked, or like I can help fundraise, or like I can do things like that, then I think it became easier for people to like be like, oh, actually, like if there is like a side out of these two groups of people who seem to be attacking each other, like I'm still on the side of people who are just like talking about sticking up for their neighbors and like opposing this like clique of rich jerks, which like, yeah, wasn't automatic, it wasn't easy, and it definitely wasn't complete, but it was also just like an interesting part.
I saw that the tower and the book fair organizers were both, I would, like, it seemed like hounded for comment by the media and, you know, really trying to press on those organizations to denounce what happened. And the tower came out with a statement that I thought was really solid, uncompromising. I think it was No Tears for Lock Street or something like that.
Yeah.
Despite what seems like an immense pressure to, you know, either hide or denounce.
Yeah. And that's what you mean about just, like, this stuff in some ways is a departure, but in some ways it's not, right? Like, it changes nothing about our ideas, it changes nothing about our engagements. The fact that we, like, will occasionally face repression or face these kinds of unpopularities, like, can't be a surprise to anyone. It's more a question of when. So I think it's kind of, it's never popular to, like, just talk about courage, but I think actually just, like, in moments like that, just being called upon to just, like, have courage and actually, like, stand up for the things that you, like, believe and hold when it's slightly difficult to do so and is not just, like, an easy to do kind of accepted part of being in, like, a scene or something, just actually is, like, important. And I think that statement was an interesting one because the tower doesn't put out statements, it doesn't do theory, it's a space, you know, and, like, within that space, like, a lot of different stuff can happen. Like, it's a physical building. But yeah, I guess, like, we just, that day we were sitting in the space in which all our bookshelves have been trashed and, like, the door was, like, kicked off and, like, the windows were busted and, like, we were just sitting there and being like, well, just talking over these ideas. There's, like, a dozen people who are out, and, like, the conversation just kind of around the people who, like, happened to show up there to be, like, physically present that day ended up, like, resulting in this statement. So it doesn't come from any, like, fixed body of people who is the tower. Like, it was sort of just an expression of the folks who had chosen to just, like, physically be present to, like, hold lines in a certain way. And the kind of political orientation of it just feels obvious, that it's, like, obviously I don't give a shit about somebody's Mercedes. Like, it doesn't matter to me at all that, like, some restaurant owned by a slumlord got its windows broken and later went out of business. Like, I only feel good about that, you know? And, like, would I have chosen to do it? Probably not, you know? Probably not in that way. But, like, it's, like, standing by it is completely uncomplicated for me, you know? And so doing, like, putting that stuff out as the tower, I think, also went a ways towards, like, opening up more, making it a little bit easier for people who are kind of facing this backlash to, like, have some language, to, like, have something else that they could put out there as being, like, I don't necessarily agree with everything, but here's this thing, you know? And, like, and begin kind of trying to carve some of that space back, because I think there, like, one way of thinking about it, I guess I just think about space a lot, but just was that attempting to just, like, take space away from us and to, like, restrict what's possible again, and just, like, to isolate certain people, and just, like, I think just trying to create tools and create moments in which we could, like, break that isolation and, like, little by little take that space back and, like, refuse to cede ground. So, like, eventually the tower got, like, pushed out of its existing space due to, like, Nazi arson threats. And then again, and, like, people used that and organized around it as an opportunity to, like, go get a better space, you know, and go, like, bring people back in, like, make more space for different kinds of activity again. So,
too busy trying to survive capitalism's daily grind to get caught up on the latest anarchist news? Or maybe you're so wrapped up in your own organizing that it's hard to make time to hear about other liberatory struggles. This Rebel Girl has got you covered. Tune in every Wednesday for new episodes of The Hot Wire, a 30-minute podcast with the latest anarchist news, on-the-ground interviews, a repression roundup, political prisoner birthdays, and announcements for upcoming events. All this and more at crimethink.com.